Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present author Lev Golinkin, who came to the U.S. as a child refugee from the Ukrainian city of Kharkov, discussing the urgent humanitarian crisis in eastern Ukraine. Anti-fracking activist Carling Southern, who talks about why she chose to engage in civil disobedience at a protest action to stop construction of a liquefied natural gas export terminal at Cove Point, Maryland. And former FCC Commissioner Michael Copps, who assesses the significance of the FCC's recently announced plan to establish net neutrality rules to preserve an open internet under Title II of the Communications Act. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Computer consultant Joaquim Sazer provides advice to diverse gatherings on how to stop governments and big business from spying on them and their computer networks. Participants in what are known as crypto parties attract millennials and retirees looking to secure their data and protect their privacy. Edward Snowden's revelations detailing massive government surveillance have raised privacy concerns across Europe. Crypto parties are popping up all over Germany, at universities, private homes, and donated office space. The goal is to learn skills necessary to remain anonymous on the internet and increase security of email and other forms of electronic communication. Ironically, Bonn, once the center of Cold War surveillance operations by East Germany's secret police, has now become a hotbed of the internet security movement. Pressure from the growing digital privacy movement is leading to new reforms throughout the 28-member European Union, from a major push by Brussels to establish greater privacy rights for European citizens to a controversial court case giving people an unprecedented right to be forgotten from the broad reach of search engines. Untreated sewage could give Rio de Janeiro's 2016 Olympic Games a black eye. According to the BBC, half of the sewage flowing into Rio's Guanabara Bay remains untreated, and promises by city officials to treat 80% of the sewage by the opening of the Games next August remain in doubt. Brazilian public health authorities have confirmed a drug-resistant superbacteria in the waters near the staging area of the Olympic sailing and windsurfing competitions. The superbug can cause urinary, gastrointestinal, and pulmonary infections not treatable by conventional drugs. The Olympic Sustainability Management Plan calls for the construction of 8 river treatment plants to filter out between 80 and 85% of the pollution that reaches the bay. With 18 months before the Olympics get underway, only 2 such plants have been built. Watchdog groups claim reducing water pollution is just one of many pledges Brazil's Olympic organizers have broken. Gisele Tanaka of the People's World Cup and Olympic Committee believes people will take to the streets to protest, as they did ahead of soccer's 2014 World Cup games. In a sign of the times, Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel appointed venture capitalist Deborah Quazzo to the city's school board in June 2013. Quazzo, whose firm GSV Advisors is heavily invested in educational technology companies like Newton, sells computer software that performs certain tasks that in the past have always been done by school staff. Since joining the Chicago School Board, Quazzo has increased her interest in companies that sell teaching materials to public schools, but she sees no conflict of interest in mixing her venture capital activities with her public policy responsibilities. The Chicago Sun-Times reported that companies Quazzo is invested in have made nearly $3 million in sales to the Chicago public school system, 3 times more than during the 3.5 years prior to her school board appointment. According to the news magazine In These Times, Chicago has become a national model for the privatization of public services, which began under former Mayor Richard M. Daley. Emanuel, who is up for re-election on February 24th, has expanded privatization initiatives while hobnobbing with investment banks and, according to his critics, has largely shunned meeting with his city's community activists. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill. We'll be right back.
24 years after the dissolution of the Soviet Union, the ongoing civil conflict in Ukraine, many worry, could provide the spark to ignite a new Cold War between Russia and the United States. The stakes are high as President Obama comes under increasing pressure by Republican war hawks and some members of his own party to send lethal weaponry to the pro-Western government in Kiev. Ukraine's government in Washington charged that separatist rebels in the two eastern Donbas provinces are being aided in their 10-month fight for autonomy by Russian-supplied weapons, including tanks and artillery, as well as direct support on the ground from Russian troops, a charge that Moscow denies. German Chancellor Angela Merkel, who recently visited the White House, has publicly opposed supplying Kiev with weapons, even as President Obama has kept that option open. Merkel and French President François Hollande are engaged in peace talks aimed at negotiating a ceasefire and a lasting peace. Many observers agree that U.S. weapons flowing into Ukraine now would likely contribute to a dangerous escalation of a conflict, which increasingly looks like a U.S.-Russian proxy war. With much of the U.S. media focused narrowly on demonizing Russian President Vladimir Putin for his annexation of Crimea last March and involvement in the current conflict, there's been little attention paid to the deepening humanitarian crisis in eastern Ukraine. According to the United Nations, more than 5,300 people have been killed and 12,200 wounded in the war zone, with another 1.5 million displaced. Your reporter spoke with Lev Golinkin, author of the book titled A Backpack, a Bear, and 8 Crates of Vodka, who came to the U.S. as a child refugee from the eastern Ukrainian city of Kharkov in 1990. Here he discusses the humanitarian crisis in eastern Ukraine and his concern about the presence of neo-Nazi groups fighting alongside the Kiev government.
There are 5.2 million people there who are not rebels, who are not soldiers, whose entire crime is just happens to be being Eastern Ukrainian and living there. And as reports from UN, from Doctors Without Borders, and from Amnesty International make clear, as far as the Eastern Ukrainians are concerned, there really isn't a hero in this situation, because both Kiev forces and the rebel forces have been indiscriminately bombing civilians. I mean, if you read the press releases from the UN, and as I put in my in the Nation, these people have just been blown apart in waiting for the bus, in going to the hospital, in walking down the street, in receiving humanitarian aid. And both Kiev forces and the rebel forces continue to do so, and both continue to deny their involvement.
As you write about in your recent articles, humanitarian aid is being blocked, as well as basic subsistence pensions coming to many elderly people in eastern Ukraine.
Exactly.
What's been the effect of this blockade, which it seems Kiev, the government in Ukraine that the U.S. supports, is blocking the aid and blocking the pensions?
Oh, yes. When it comes to shelling, it seems that both sides are responsible. When it comes to the blockade, that is solely Kiev's creation. And as I wrote in the New York Times 2 months ago, the idea was we're going to blockade this region because otherwise the separatists, the rebels are going to be using this pension money to buy weapons. Obviously they're not. The rebels aren't using food stamps to buy missiles. The only people who are really affected by this blockade are the Eastern Ukrainians. And moreover, the people who were the most affected by it, the 1.4 million who are classified as highly vulnerable, are the pensioners, the people who are too sick, too poor, or too destitute to go anywhere. So this blockade, Kiev is blocking banking so you can't get any money. It's blocking pensions, which is what these people are relying on. And in addition, Kiev is making it very hard for even humanitarian groups to bring aid into the area, including medicine. Doctors Without Borders just slammed Kiev in The Guardian for putting up everything from red tape to refusing to let medicines clear in the area. So overall, what you have is a region that's been decimated by shelling. The entire infrastructure is gone, and you're lacking the most basic supplies, and Kiev is helping prevent these supplies from getting in there, which is a horrific thing.
Lev, I wondered if you would discuss for us some of your concern about these extreme right neo-Nazi militia groups such as the Azov Battalion. There are parties such as Right Sector and Svoboda, also ultra-nationalist groups. They seem quite close to the Kiev government and are fighting in the field in eastern Ukraine. They've been accused of many atrocities. These were some of the groups that fought the police in Kiev about a year ago when an uprising overthrew the elected government of Viktor Yanukovych. Speak to us of the extreme right and their association with this Washington-backed government in Kiev.
The people that rose up in Maidan, I mean, it was a very diverse coalition. A lot of them are just everyday people who want to change. But a disturbing part of it is the far right, these neo-Nazis who are not pro-Western, who are not liberal, who are decidedly anti-democratic. And they have a very narrow-minded version of what Ukraine should be. A couple of them have seats in the Rada, the current Ukrainian parliament. In the past, Svoboda was named the Social Nationalist Party, which is a direct relationship to the Nazis. They use Nazi salutes. They use Nazi insignia. So a lot of these groups are very disturbing. The problem is Moscow used their existence to say, hey, listen, everybody in Kiev is a neo-Nazi, which is not true at all. But the neo-Nazis, these fascist groups, do exist. They have armed battalions, and they are part of this Kiev government. And that's something that's not really been addressed by the United States at all. My whole thing is we need to be careful who it is we're talking about arming and who it is we're talking about supporting, and make sure that the people who are backing are the people who are democratic and are pro-Western.
That was Lev Golinkin, author of A Backpack, a Bear, and 8 Crates of Vodka, who grew up in the eastern Ukrainian city of Kharkov. Find Golinkin's recent articles on Ukraine and related analysis by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On February 3rd, an anti-fracking activist climbed a 150-foot crane on the site of Dominion Resources Liquid Natural Gas, or LNG, refinery and export terminal under construction at Cove Point, Maryland. Carling Southern, 27, works as a teacher at a farm school in Baltimore and is a member of the group SEED, Stopping Extraction and Exports Destruction. It's one of many organizations, local and regional, campaigning to stop the $3.8 billion LNG project. Opponents say the LNG terminal will bring noise and dangerous pollution to residents living near the site in the town of Lusby, greatly increase fracking throughout the Marcellus Shale region where natural gas is extracted, and blow a hole in any attempt to rein in carbon pollution to keep climate change from going into overdrive. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus, who's worked on the Cove Point issue, spoke with Southern after she was brought down from the crane, arrested, and released. Here she explains what motivated her to engage in this civil disobedience action and what she believes is at risk if the export terminal is built.
Heather Doyle and I entered the Dominion Cove Point site, and we proceeded to climb onto the crane structure, and Heather was my belay person as I climbed to the top of the crane. And at the top, I unfurled a banner that read, "Dominion, get out," and "Don't frack Maryland," and "No gas export," and "Save Cove Point."
How did you get down from the top of the crane?
I tried to come down on my own by asking for my rope back. The end of my rope, the part that Heather was attached to, once Heather was removed from the crane, the police officer tied off the end of my rope so that I could not retrieve my rope to allow myself to come down on my own. So they lowered the crane with me on it. So I felt a bit unsafe because I didn't know what was happening.
Carling Southern, what led you to take this kind of action, which seems like could be pretty risky to your safety and also carry a legal risk?
I've actually been out of the country for a little while, and I returned back to Maryland this past summer. And pretty soon after I got back to Maryland, I found out about this project, Dominion's project in Cove Point. And for the last few years, I've been learning more about natural gas fracking and its impacts on the environment and the communities where this process is happening, and have felt very strongly against the practice of natural gas drilling. And when I found out about this project, the more I was learning about the impact that it would have, the more I wanted to do something about it. So I found a group of people that were actively working on stopping this project from happening. And in the last few months, there's been a lot of activity as far as protests and actions taken to raise awareness about what this project is going to mean for the nearby community, but also the region and even beyond just Maryland.
What do you think those impacts are or could be?
In the immediate region, well, they're clear-cutting lots of land for this project. They're not even hiring local folk. And to send natural gas abroad means that the prices of natural gas here in the U.S. are going to go up. It also means that if we're starting to ship natural gas outside of the U.S., that we're going to need to be producing more natural gas in the U.S. Right now, there is no fracking happening in Maryland, but it seems very likely that it will be on the table shortly, especially with a new governor that supports it. So in Western Maryland, there is the Marcellus Shale, which is an area where lots of natural gas exists underground, and so it's somewhat easily accessible. So the likelihood that natural gas fracking will start happening in Western Maryland seems very high. And once that happens, then the natural gas needs to get to the export facility somehow, and that would be through pipelines. So there's going to be thousands of miles of pipelines built to transport this gas to the export facility. Also, at this particular Cove Point facility, they have to build a plant to change the gas from gas to liquid. The liquid makes it so that it's easier to ship. There's lots of negative environmental impacts associated with that process. So on various levels, there's not going to be any benefit to the community.
The Cove Point LNG export terminal has gotten all its approvals and is already under construction. So do you really think there's any chance of stopping it?
If I didn't think there was a chance of stopping it, I wouldn't have done what I did the other day. I absolutely still believe that we have the power to cancel this project, to stop them where they're at now. And I believe in the people that are putting their lives on the line and that are organizing. I believe in our power of community to make sure that Dominion doesn't move forward with this project. I think it's a big challenge, and Dominion has a lot of money, but there's a lot of willpower, and we're willing to fight, and you know, we know what's at risk, and we're going to do what we can to stop it.
That was Carling Southern of the group SEED, Stopping Extraction and Exports Destruction. Southern was charged with trespassing and failure to obey a lawful order, both misdemeanors, and has a court date in March. Several other activists who also disrupted construction at the site go to court on February 23rd. Learn more about groups opposed to natural gas fracking by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. When President Obama issued a statement on November 10th declaring his public support for net neutrality, a principle that all traffic on the Internet should be treated equally, it was considered likely that the Federal Communications Chairman he had appointed, Tom Wheeler, would fall into line and issue new rules. It was less than a year ago, in May 2014, that Wheeler proposed a tiered Internet, where a fee-based system would determine the speed at which content would be delivered to consumers, primarily benefiting telecom giants like AT&T, Comcast, and Verizon. The public's response was quick and decidedly negative. 4 million people sent public comments to the FCC, objecting to his scheme. responding to growing public pressure and following the lead of his boss in the White House. Wheeler backed away from his earlier proposal and on February 4th announced that he will issue new net neutrality rules anchored to Title II of the Communications Act, a strategy open Internet activists had been advocating for many years. The five FCC commissioners are expected to vote on Wheeler's new rules on February 26th. While it appears that new net neutrality rules regulating broadband Internet service as a public utility will be approved, it's likely that those rules will very quickly come under attack. Big cable and phone companies have signaled that they're ready to file lawsuits and send an army of lobbyists to push for legislation that will weaken or disable new FCC Internet regulations. Your reporter spoke with former FCC Commissioner Michael Copps, who talks about the significance of the proposed FCC net neutrality rules, the important role played by grassroots activism, and the battles ahead that still must be fought.
We seem to be on the cusp of a victory here, much closer than when last we spoke. I always caution, though, that it's not over until it's over. I never underestimate the power of the special interests and their ability to bring legions of lobbyists and wheelbarrows of money to Washington, D.C. You'll notice that their ads haven't diminished in recent weeks against what the FCC is doing. So we have about 17 days to go, I think, until the vote, and we need to be vigilant then. But what's at issue here is the future of the central communications infrastructure of our time, communications and the broadband Internet. This is increasingly the infrastructure we use to find jobs, to do our jobs, to educate ourselves, take care of our health, and do a whole host of other things. And we were on the danger without any open Internet rules or net neutrality, as some would call them. Well, that's kind of an anodyne expression, but open Internet or Internet freedom rules to make sure that this broadband network isn't controlled by a handful of gatekeepers and special interests who can control access into our house, who can favor their friend, their own affiliates and their business friends and speed up their ability to get into our homes over our Internet fibers and so forth and slow down people who they might not want to have that kind of access. An absence of rules like that is not just an economic threat and a commercial threat, but it's a threat to our democracy, too, as we have talked before. And at stake is our ability to communicate, our news, our information, and our civic dialogue and all the rest. So what we're trying to make sure now, again, is that a few people cannot be in charge of this public good that is the Internet.
Commissioner Copps, there are many people in this country who are quite cynical, and unfortunately many people believe our system is broken, both political and economic, and is now the purview and the playing ground of these large, these giant corporations who can spread money around and get their way in Washington.
Right.
If you were to lay out sort of the things that this movement did right, what specifically are the strategies and tactics that you think worked to the advantage of these activists in pushing for net neutrality?
Well, number one, we had a good and just and apparently obvious, well, maybe obvious is too strong a word, but a just cause that people could understand. And I think that came along at a time in our country's history when people are becoming more and more aware of the power of special interests and big money and the need to do something about that. But I think this came not from the top, but I think this came from the bottoms up. And I think it's sort of like all great reform movements in our country, is civil rights or disability rights or worker rights, or you can go right on down the list. Those things that really make a difference get their nourishment, get their strength from the grassroots. You know, you ask, why did the president wait for as long as he did? Well, maybe it took that long for them to realize that really this was a mass movement in this constituency that he had depended upon of young people on the Internet was really getting worried about the future and expected him to cross some T's and dot some I's on the commitment that he had made to network neutrality and make sure we came out with a strong package of net neutrality protections, such as those that Tom Wheeler is propounding for February 26.
Well, just lastly, Commissioner Copps, in this next stage of the fight for net neutrality rules, how important is grassroots activism when the courts and Congress weigh in on this?
It's going to be vitally, critically important when it comes to the Congress. And this is not a red state or a blue state issue. There's not one party that favors a few people controlling the access to the Internet. Americans want an open Internet, and there have been polls recently that show it's 80% of Republicans and 80% of Democrats are specifically in favor of no fast lanes on the Internet. It's probably more than that, but, you know, that's pretty high rating for the polls. But the Congress is going to go ahead. What will slow Congress down is the understanding that at the grassroots, people do care. What will slow Congress down is when that senator or congressman comes home and has a town hall meeting and somebody raises his or her hand and says, hey, where are you on this Internet freedom and where are you on network neutrality? And if you're going the other way or you want to get rid of these rules, why are you doing that? What's your rationale for doing that? That makes a huge difference. I saw that when we did the media ownership thing back 10 or 12 years ago, and I had members of Congress tell me, you know, I never heard about this issue until a couple of months ago, and I went home and somebody raised a hand and asked me about media ownership, and I saw it at the next meeting, too. That congressman came back and voted to overturn Michael Powell's rules that were loosening the media ownership rules. So grassroots pressure can make a difference, and if there are those in Congress who are really going to push this, and I hope they're having second thoughts right now when they begin to see the reaction to this. But that's when grassroots is going to become critically important.
That was former FCC Commissioner Michael Copps, who served on the commission from 2001 to 2011. He now works as a special advisor to Common Cause. Find information on groups continuing to campaign for an open Internet by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Richard Hill, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.